There was a great study done recently of divergent thinking, published a couple of years ago. Divergent thinking isn't the same thing as creativity. I define creativity as the process of having original ideas that have value. Divergent thinking isn't a synonym, but it's an essential capacity for creativity. It's the ability to see lots of possible answers to a question, lots of possible ways of interpreting a question, to think what Edward de Bono would probably call laterally, to think not just in linear or convergent ways, to see multiple answers, not one. So, I mean, there are tests for this. I mean, one kind of cod example would be people might be asked to say, how many uses can you think of for a paperclip? Well, those routine questions. Most people might come up with 10 or 15. People who are good at this might come up with 200. And they do that by saying, well, could the paperclip be 200 foot tall and be made out of foam rubber? You know, like, does it have to be a paperclip as we know it, Jim? You know. Now, there are tests for this, and they gave them to 1,500 people. This is in a book called Breakpoint and Beyond. And on the protocol of the test, if you scored above a certain level, you'd be considered to be a genius at divergent thinking. Okay? So my question to you is, what percentage of the people tested, of the 1,500, scored at genius level for divergent thinking? Now, you need to know one more thing about them. These were kindergarten children. So what do you think? What percentage at genius level? 80, okay. 98%. Now, the thing about this was it was a longitudinal study. So they retested the same children 5 years later, age of 8 to 10. What do you think? 15? They retested them again 5 years later, ages 13 to 15. You can see a trend here, can't you? Now, this tells an interesting story, because you could have imagined it going the other way, couldn't you? You start off not being very good, but you get better as you get older. But this shows two things. One is, we all have this capacity, and two, it mostly deteriorates. Now, a lot of things have happened to these kids as they've grown up. A lot. But one of the most important things that happened, I'm convinced, is that by now, they've become educated. You know, they've spent 10 years at school being told there's one answer, it's at the back. And don't look. And don't copy, because that's cheating. I mean, outside schools, that's called collaboration. You know, but inside schools. Now, this isn't because teachers want it this way. It's just because it happens that way. It's because it's in the gene pool of education. We have to think differently about human capacity. We have to get over this old conception of academic, non-academic, abstract, theoretical, vocational, and see it for what it is, a myth. Secondly, we have to recognize that most great learning happens in groups, that collaboration is the stuff of growth. If we atomize people and separate them and judge them separately, we form a kind of disjunction between them and their natural learning environment. And thirdly, it's crucially about the culture of our institutions, the habits of the institution and the habitats that they occupy.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey everybody, this is Brett, and this podcast is just a quick zippity-do through a list of items that I put together as a follow-up from the last show. We're just going to try and do like a stream of consciousness thing here. Some practical strategies and considerations for thinking differently, for thinking divergently, and hopefully thinking more creatively. So in the last show, we talked about some of the models that were created earlier in the 20th century for creative problem solving. And today I'm going to talk about some specific actions that I've been trying to make part of my fairly regular routine since I first encountered this information back in January when I was preparing the productivity shows. And I'll give everybody a couple of days to digest this show and the previous show, and then we'll move on to next week's guests, Julia Turyanskaya and Jeffrey Tucker. Today, I'm going to be using that Osborne, the creative problem-solving process, which has existed in a few different forms since it was first developed in the 1950s. But just to run through one version of it, there are 6 or 7 steps. Today, we're going to add an extra step, which I think is a really, really important one called incubation. And it was a part of the other models that we discussed as well. So this is the structure that we're going to use. Step one, orientation, pointing out and pointing up the problem, clear definition of what you're looking to solve, and a clear envisioning of what the solution looks like. Preparation, gathering the pertinent data, gathering raw material, as James Webb Young called it. We also talked about Young's book, A Technique for Producing Ideas. Analysis, breaking down the relevant material, digesting it. Ideation, piling up alternatives by way of ideas. So this is the part where we just try to generate as many solutions as possible without a tremendous amount of criticism or judgment. Now, here's what we're adding today, because you might remember in the last show, we discussed the creative problem-solving process as 3 main steps, each step composed of 2 parts. So what we've gone through first using that model is step one, fact-finding, which is the pointing out and pointing up the problem, followed by preparation, which is gathering and analyzing pertinent data. Then step two, idea finding, which is ideation, idea production, thinking up ideas and possible leads. And that's followed by more of a refinement process, idea development, where you select and add or reprocess ideas. So a more critical eye comes in the second part of step two, idea finding. So I know this might be a little bit hard to follow. Please don't hesitate to reference the show notes. There are diagrams there. We've covered 2 main steps composed of 4 total parts. So we are now on to part 5, the one I'm adding today, which is called incubation. Very essential to the other models of Wallace in The Art of Thought and Young in The Technique for Producing Ideas. Pulling back a little bit and putting something aside, hopefully to invite some kind of illumination or subconscious participation. As Young put it, he said, it is important to realize that this is just as definite and just as necessary a stage in the process as the 2 preceding ones. What you have to do at this time, apparently, is to turn the problem over to your unconscious mind and let it work while you sleep. When you reach this third stage in the production of an idea, drop the problem completely and turn to whatever stimulates your imagination and emotions. Listen to music, go to the theater, movies, read poetry, or a detective story. So we'll talk about that more, because that is advice I have applied to my daily life in the last few months. And then we go on to the third step in Osborne's model and its 2 parts, solution finding, which is a kind of evaluation, verification of tentative solutions, and ultimately adoption, deciding and implementing what ultimately you think or a group thinks will work best, and maybe testing it out. So following the research that I did on this subject, I want to talk to you about some things that I've actually implemented in my life, and these include both attitudes and actions. So I think creating the right conditions for creative work, and this is a very recent realization, I think there's a kind of no-pressure attitude that I really have to adopt. I've realized the way I set up my show in 2016 is not really conducive to me maximizing my creative potential, because whether it's January or February or this month of March, I've got about 30 days to get everything done. So it's actually been really difficult to just say, this isn't exactly how I want it yet, or I feel like this could be better, or I feel like this could be enhanced, but deadlines are calling and I just have to let it go. I haven't really worked that way in a while. And, you know, I was wondering if deadlines would produce a kind of pressure that would, in a way, force me to do better work. But it really hasn't been the case. I like it when, you know, I can spend 10 hours on a project if I need to, or I can spend, you know, 25 or 30 hours on a project if I need to, even though that is very rare that anything would take that long. So what's the takeaway here? A good metaphor to use would be like planting seeds. You go out and you plant some seeds, and once in a while, a seed grows into a beautiful flower or a nutritious plant that you can pick the fruits of and eat, or even, if you're young enough, a beautiful tree that one day you can build a swing in one of its branches for your grandchildren. But some just dry up and grow nothing. Maybe most of them. And the attitude adjustment should be that that's completely fine and predictable, but just remember to keep planting seeds. So the trap that I've set for myself with the School Sucks 4.0 format here is that every seed I plant has to be a beautiful flower. There's been, you know, maybe there's been a few exceptions. I haven't been 100% thrilled with everything that I put out so far this year. And at the end of January, I even felt a little burnt out. So now I'm in the process of re-strategizing to say, okay, well, how can this problem be solved? Because I really would like to be proactive and plan ahead so I don't find myself having to settle for anything along the way just to be able to, say, complete a theme by the end of the month. Both January and February, I put out the last piece in the theme with hours to spare on the last day of the month. And if it wasn't for leap year, in February, if it wasn't for leap year, I wouldn't have made it. So setting the right conditions for creativity means eliminating pressure wherever you can. Some people might say they work better under pressure. You might be more productive under pressure, but I really don't think too many people could argue that they're more creative under pressure. So that first consideration has to do with setting the right conditions for creativity. So we're going to talk now about some strategies for the incubation portion of this model. First, very simply, do something different. So in the latter half of 2015, and then really, really in January and February and right up to today, for the sake of maximizing productivity, I have been trying to refine and make concrete a daily routine, especially a morning routine. I wake up in the morning, I stand up, I make my bed, I leave my bedroom, I walk down the hall, I go into the kitchen, I fill a water bottle, I fill a coffee pot. While the coffee brews, I go and I meditate, I do some stretches. When that is done, the coffee is ready. I add butter, I add coconut oil, I put it in my magic bullet, I pour it in a mug, I go to my desk, I take out my journal, I write in my journal, and sip my coffee. Then I close my journal, I open Evernote, I create a daily action list, I look at my calendar, I make a to-do list out of calendar items, I do 3 Pomodoros, each 25 minutes, based on the to-do list, then I make breakfast, then I eat breakfast, then I go for a walk, and that is the routine. And it should be about noon. While having a strict routine is very nice in many ways, sometimes something different really just needs to happen to get those juices flowing, if you know what I mean. So part of this is a walk. And just here's like an example of a little shakeup that I would do. It doesn't have to be anything major because, the rest of my day afternoon follows a pretty predictable routine as well. So I say, okay, it's time to go for a walk. I usually put on my sneakers and I go out on the road. I live in a city. There's plenty of different routes I could walk and try to get in, 4,000, 5,000 steps right there to make sure I'm going to make my daily step total. So yesterday, I don't know, it was a beautiful day and I looked out the window and I said, I think I'm going to do something different. So instead of putting on sneakers, I put on boots. I put on some scrappy old clothes. And I just went and started to walk very, very briskly through the woods behind where I live. So there's like a kind of wooded area that ultimately comes out at a set of railroad tracks. And then on the other side of the railroad tracks is a river. So I kind of almost run through the woods, like darting in and out of trees. So this is something totally different to me than just walking on the road. I also did not bring headphones, because usually on my walks I'll listen to audiobooks or podcasts, but it's just me and the sounds of nature and the sounds of the leaves under my feet. And this went on for about, I don't know, 10 minutes, and ultimately I wind up at these railroad tracks. I say, this is interesting. And the tracks are hardly ever used. Sometimes like a very slow freight train will go by at 4 o'clock in the morning. So I start walking down the tracks. And once I get a little bit away from civilization, I start finding all these strange, abandoned, homeless people camps, like furniture and old mattresses and old clothes and tarps and trash and beer cans. And it's interesting. So I just walk, and then there's another one, and then there's another one. And eventually I make it down to I go under a bridge of this road that I drive over all the time, but never thought about what was underneath me. And there's like this fire pit and all this cool graffiti. And I walk a little bit more, and I come to this waterfall, like dam, where there's also like this fish hatchery place. And wherever I could, I would go off the tracks and into whatever woods was available. And it was interesting. There was all these paths through the woods by the river. This was wonderful. And on the way back, once I got closer to civilization, I was walking along the tracks, and I looked up, and there's like a condo complex. And in the condo complex, on the grass, there's this cat, and it's just staring at me. So I stop. And again, no audio, just me and nature and cat, domestic cat. And we just stare at each other. And you know, like a minute goes by. And then I say to myself, I didn't think a cat had this kind of attention span. I wonder how long we will actually just stare at each other. So I started to count 1-1,000, 2-1,000, 3-1,000, 4-1,000. And it went on for like probably dead serious, almost 3 more minutes. The cat didn't look away. And then I took out my phone and I took a picture of the cat staring at me. And then finally the cat won the staring contest. After about 3 minutes, I just continued on down the tracks. So then I get back to this area of woods where I think if I go into the woods here, this will take me back pretty close to where I live. So I start running through the woods, dodging trees and tripping on sticks and stuff like that. I even fell in a creek, kind of behavior you might expect from a crazy old hobo. There's this creek by my house, and usually it's very calm and very little water in it, but it's been raining here, and obviously there's snow melt. There's a lot of extra water from snow melting because it's been really nice. So this thing is like a river almost, and I have to cross it. So I had to jump from rock to rock to rock. And then the last leap was like 6 feet where I thought I could just kind of dive to the other side, and didn't make it, went in about a little above my knees. But fortunately, I was right by my house, so how nice. I was only wet with the water of an old creek for a minute or two. So that's different. That's a different thing than walking down the street and listening to, you know, the Gavin McGinnis show. Now, novel experience is an excellent kind of snap to break thinking patterns. And I think that it's an accumulation of things like that. Seeing something like I saw the entire walk yesterday, because even if I'm on the street and I go like a different route, I'm walking on pavement. There's cars going by. I'm listening to familiar voices. It's a routine. So and what I did yesterday is just a recent example of trying to break out of comfortable activity. Now, we could even make this a more general piece of advice, and we could call it leaving. Right? Just sometimes I'll just feel really, really stagnant in the middle of a work day. So I'll go out and I'll get in my car and I'll just get kind of lost. But I'll just go out and drive through the city of Manchester and see a few things that I haven't seen before. And this is particularly, this might sound like obvious to you, but this is really important to me because I work from home. I'm kind of a homebody. I have a tendency to isolate myself socially, which also since last October, I've been being very, very conscious about not doing this. And I've had wonderful experiences. I've met wonderful people. I've had great adventures. Follow me on Instagram by the way. Let me do more adventures, and then I'll give you my Instagram information. So when it comes to incubation, two pieces of advice: break a routine or alter a routine so it's something different and novel, or leave completely. Abandon what is, you know, the typical day to have some kind of adventure. And then finally, this is a really interesting one, and it was one that I did a lot more of in the last year, was do nothing. These phones that we have are absolutely ridiculous, and mine is definitely a problem. I have it with me all the time. You know, I don't remember what show it was, but I know we talked about this before. Being still and alone with your thoughts is very, very interesting, for me anyway. I think it's very good for a kind of conscious living, but it's also very helpful to, you know, get inside one's own head once one has some idea of how to operate it in a beneficial way. I think that's the advice we get a lot in life. Like, oh, you got to get out of your head. Don't think too much. I don't really think that that's good advice. I think, you know, learning how to understand what's going on in one's mind is a very helpful activity. And then once you do that, spend some time there. So the daily practice of meditation has been extremely helpful for that. Just sitting quietly and really trying to think of nothing, just trying to concentrate on breath or on some kind of fairly consistent sound or some other small piece of sensory information. But the thoughts do come. And, you know, you just say, ooh, how interesting. And you acknowledge it and then just kind of move on and return your focus to whatever that sensory input is on which you chose to focus. There was this neurologist who was on Rogan maybe like 6 months ago, and he talked about this as like the workout routine of meditation. The rep is the thought comes in, which is like the negative, pushing, you know, letting the weight come down on top of you. And then the positive movement, which is pushing it away, saying, thank you for coming, goodbye. But it's also interesting, and this is one of the reasons why I do this before I write in a journal in the morning. It's interesting to reflect on what comes and to ask questions like, why did that show up? Why did my subconscious fire that into my conscious thinking? And maybe write about it and explore it. I think that's very, very useful. But the phone, you know, I'm holding it all the time. I've got my podcast app on there. I've got my Words with Friends. And I'm always diddling with it. I try not to open like Twitter or Facebook that much, but I'm always diddling this phone. I realized that I was stealing opportunities for myself to just be in my own head and experience that. So I've made a conscious effort to do more of that in the last few months and to pay attention to those weird thoughts, because they are often the seeds of, you know, very, very interesting ideas that if recorded could be made useful. I just used to like sit there and think and go, oh, that's weird. Oh, that's kind of interesting. But then they would just kind of pass me by. And I wouldn't really think about it anymore. I mean, that could have been like, you know, a whole YouTube series if those thoughts were properly captured and extracted and expanded upon. But I just let them go. So I've been trying to be more conscious of what's going on in my head. And all of that relates to incubation. Letting go of a conscious effort to solve creative problems or to generate interesting ideas and just turning it over to the subconscious and seeing what happens. So then I wanted to talk a little bit about another step from the creative problem solving process, ideation, which is basically just idea production, thinking up ideas and possible leads. So ideation obviously differs from incubation because you're taking conscious action to come up with solutions to some kind of problem that requires creativity or divergent thinking. Oh, by the way, just a definition, because I've used the term a couple of times. Divergent thinking opposed to convergent thinking. So in school or on standardized tests, we think convergently. essentially. I'm just going to give you the Wikipedia definition. Convergent thinking is the type of thinking that focuses on coming up with a single, well-established answer to a problem. It is orientated towards deriving the single best or often the most correct answer to a question. Therefore, it obviously does have its place in things like, you know, science or mathematics. And in science, it's often more temporary than, of course, in mathematics. Convergent thinking emphasizes speed, accuracy, and logic and focuses on recognizing the familiar, reapplying techniques, and accumulating stored information. It is most effective in situations where an answer readily exists and simply needs to either be recalled or worked out through decision-making strategies. A critical aspect of convergent thinking is that it leads to a single best answer, leaving no room for ambiguity. In this view, answers are either right or wrong. So obviously, convergent thinking is an important kind of cognitive tool. Continuing, the solution that is derived at the end of the convergent thinking process is the best possible answer the majority of the time. So now I'm going to jump to a Psychology Today article by Tony Bernhard, What Type of Thinker Are You, to define divergent thinking. By contrast, divergent means developing in different directions. And so divergent thinking opens your mind in all directions. This opens possibilities in your life because it leads you to look for options that aren't necessarily apparent at first. The divergent thinker is looking for options as opposed to choosing among predetermined ones. Gary Johnson, 2016, folks, am I right? So sometimes when I was a teacher, I would do this morning warm-up exercise with kids. I used to teach algebra, and the class was like first thing in the morning. So it was like 8 o'clock in the morning. And these kids who, you know, had just been dragged into the school that I worked at, this was the second school that I worked at. It was a day school. So the kids came from home. They could have been out, you know, partying the night before. And I had to teach them algebra. So I'd usually start with these kind of creative thinking or free association type exercises or activities. And I would just do a kind of a problem-solution game where I would identify a problem, or I'd let one of them pick a problem, and then I would just come up with some kind of object that they had to use in a solution. So like problem, flat tire, object, ketchup packet. Don't worry about sounding like an idiot and start trying to bridge this gap between flat tire and ketchup packet and just talk. Anything. There's no right answer. Like, you know, algebra was very convergent thinking. There were right and wrong answers, and the kids were often like embarrassed or frustrated by not knowing what they were doing. So like, let's take some of the tension and the pressure out of this room by just being silly and just saying dumb things. And you know, when it starts, it's obviously like the most convergent kinds of solutions, right? Like, oh, yeah, you know, I just made that example up. I don't know if I've ever really used flat tire ketchup packet, but it's like, yeah, you know, you squirt ketchup in the hole in the tire and let it kind of dry so it makes the patches the hole. Yeah, it starts like that. And what's really interesting about this exercise, it's not the solutions that you get, because in practical terms, all of the solution seed ideas are pretty stupid. At least when you first hear them. But that's not what it's about. It's really about the questions it generates. What about this situation with the flat tire? Or what about this aspect of the ketchup packet? Like, once you open this up, some really interesting things start to happen. And what's even more valuable was the way that it changes the environment in the room. Before or without this, everybody is just kind of sucking at algebra all by his or herself. But this creates a kind of collaborative, open, friendly, looser environment that actually led to more productive, convergent thinking when it had to take place, because, of course, you need both. And I'm trying to think more about some of the tool ideas that we used to use. They wouldn't all just be inanimate objects. They could be circumstances or conditions like invisibility, or having a change of heart, or using a billboard, or something like having a famous relative. Another thing I remember, we also used to play this game called New Words. Now, I probably wouldn't stand by this today, because being less of like a left-wing relativist hippie than I was then, I like accuracy and precision in language. And I only mention this because it actually led to something really, it solved a really interesting problem that I had as a teacher, and part of the role of a teacher was a disciplinarian. So I worked at this school from 2004 to 2006. So this was the height of a Comedy Central program called The Chappelle Show. But the kids would come in and they would say lines from the Chappelle Show, the Rick James skit. They would use the N-word. And using this new words game that we would play, the proper word for the solution to your problem might not even exist yet. So make it up. And the example that I would give, I was really into like quantum physics and what the bleep do we know. And the example that I would use is like quarks in physics. The quark was essentially invented to solve a kind of a problem. It filled a need to describe something before there was evidence that that something actually even existed. So we would play this game sometimes, and or it would just kind of spring up spontaneously more in history class than in math class. And so I had kids saying the F word, saying the N word, and it was kind of a problem because the administrators would pass by and they could hear kids shouting these things or reciting Chappelle Show skits in my class. And I didn't really want to get spoken to about that. So I said, guys, I think that just doing this kind of thing to get a reaction out of me is a little bit played out. What if we invent our own language of curses? And I think it would be way funnier, but it would also be like maybe very refreshing. And these kids started to come up with words they could say to each other and not get in trouble while amusing themselves. And they could do it in front of the administrators. So I remember one kid called another kid this combination of bastard and ass, which was bass, which is also a fish. You're being a real bass. Which I found massively enjoyable, and so did they. And so these were actually, now that I'm thinking more about it, they were actually new definitions for pre-existing words or combinations of words. So another one was cornbird, which was particularly harsh in this language. And I did ultimately actually have to speak to kids about calling each other cornbird too often. The students that I taught were always testing limits. Right. And they were always getting in trouble. And, you know, these are the kinds of traits that are often associated with divergent thinking, curiosity, risk taking, nonconformity. So this was like a quality use of our time to do divergent thinking activities versus just kind of like forcing them to go through, you know, algebra problems. We did have to do a little bit of that, too. But promoting divergent thinking, even though I didn't have that term then, you know, and I was much more in like reading Timothy Leary after school and Robert Anton Wilson then. So I was a bit more of a space cadet, which is probably why I did those things. But I guess my instincts were good because school, especially math in school, doesn't really produce many opportunities for creative thinking. So anyway, that was a tangent. How do I promote my own divergent thinking today? All right, I'd say there's three strategies: reading, writing, and what I guess I will call synthesis. And again, this is all strategies for ideation, generating as many solutions to a problem as possible without being very critical of what they are. You know, you've got a flat tire, you've got a ketchup packet. This isn't really the time to be super critical of the solutions you come up with. A piece of advice that I got, I think this came from James Altucher, who I'm still trying to get on the show. He said, every day, read or skim chapters from books on at least four different topics. Well, I would expand this beyond really just reading. Like sometimes this would be like maybe a way to acclimate yourself to doing something like this. We all spend time on Facebook. We all have news feeds. There's things that we are prone to click and there's things that we're prone to scroll beyond. So one of the things that I have been doing in the last few months is clicking on things I normally wouldn't click on, things that would I would usually just completely, like something that somebody that I went to high school with would post. You know, and it could be about pop culture. It could be some news item that I don't give a shit about. But I'll say, I would never read that. Click open and I would read it. And sometimes I just skim it really quick. Sometimes I just read the headlines. Sometimes I just look at the pictures. Sometimes I just read, you know, the first sentence of each paragraph. But putting something different into my mind that wouldn't have been there. And you know, trying to do that, you know, a handful of times every day. In upcoming shows, you're going to hear me talk about not reading enough fiction. But I do have a limited number of fiction books here. So last night I had a copy of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which I've actually never read. I know I've helped kids as a tutor like write reports about that book, but I've never actually read it myself. I've seen the famous Hollywood movie from the 30s. But I've never read the book. So yesterday I just picked it up and I read it for like 30 minutes from the beginning. How fascinating. And then I put it down, and I put it back on the shelf. But it's just a very simple act of putting new narratives into my mind and just seeing what collisions happen as a result of that. And, you know, another thing that I did, and this is like a very recent development, just in the last 3 weeks or so, I've been playing chess. And I just downloaded obviously I was inspired to do this by my conversations with Steve. It's a more thoughtful and engaging activity than Words with Friends, even though that has, you know, its benefits, or diddling around on Facebook, which I do sometimes. And, you know, I'm a novice, right? So I just play against the computer, and you can set the level of difficulty. I think it's like on a scale of 1 to 10. So I started at like a 2 or a 3, and I've worked my way up to like a 5 or a 6. And then when I can consistently win games at that level, I go to the next level. So one of the observations that I've made is that when the game begins, there's a tremendous number of options. I know it's not infinite, but every time you make a decision and commit to a move, the number of future possibilities decreases significantly until ultimately in a chess game, you get to a place where there is only one option left. And I, with some of the work that I've done, have made decisions too hastily. I've committed to something and then moved, and then that eliminates my opportunity to take advantage or to experience all kinds of other possibilities. And it's not like I really can't go back in real life like a chess game, but there's this like level of commitment, right? Like I invested this time. I think this is the best decision. I'm going to do it, and I'm going to keep moving forward from there. But in the beginning, I might have been sloppy about how I was making decisions. So one of the things that I've tried to do is just when I feel like there's a problem that I want to address, and my webmaster, my conversations with my webmaster were really helpful to this end, because he's very good at asking questions that get me thinking in novel ways. And, you know, I have scratch pads. Like there's people that I talk to on a regular basis, and in Evernote, I just keep little scratch pads of our conversation. So if something interesting comes up, I just jot it down. But then sometimes after the conversation, I kind of look back at, you know, maybe some of the notes, and I will just fire off a list of options for maybe a problem that we were talking about. Now, this kind of ideation is in response to solving a problem, right? So I'm writing down options for a pre-existing problem, but I think there's an even more proactive approach to this, which I also got from James Altucher. Write down 10 ideas. And what Altucher wrote about it, and I'll link his article in the show notes, about anything. It doesn't matter if they are business ideas, book ideas, ideas for surprising your spouse in bed, ideas for what you do if you are arrested for shoplifting, ideas for how to make a better tennis racket, anything you want. The key is that it has to be 10 or more. You want your brain to sweat. One possibility right now is to list 10 ideas that are too big for me, and what the next steps might be. For instance, one idea might be launch solar panels into outer space to more effectively generate solar power. Another idea might be genetically engineer a microbe that sucks the salt out of water. I have no idea if that's even possible. Another idea might be within 1 year, I'm going to write a book and give away 1 million copies for free. The first step would be to write the book. Then maybe I can crowdfund on Kickstarter to give the book away for free. Or maybe I can print up nano-sized copies of the book so that you can only read it with a microscope, but it would only cost me a couple of sheets of paper to print up 1 million copies, and so on. With the solar panels, I can call up SpaceX to see how much it would cost to rent space. for the microbe that desalinates. I have no idea. Can you help me? I don't ever want to look at these ideas again. The purpose is not to come up with a good idea. The purpose is to have thousands of ideas over time, to develop the ideal muscle and turn it into a machine. Now, when I first read that, one of the reasons why I think that really resonated with me is the experience that I had, kind of a pretty trying experience at some points, trying to complete a workbook written by Nathaniel Brandon called The Art of Self-Discovery, which I don't have in front of me right now, but we've talked about on the show in the past. We talked about it in episode 350, which was about journaling, where Brandon gives the reader or the participant prompts based on a certain subject area or examination that needs to be done in life, you know, relationships with family, relationships with self, attitudes, etc. And you take the prompt and you try to write down 12 stems, 12 ways of finishing the sentence. So like a prompt would be, when my mom did blank, I felt dot, dot, dot. In the beginning of when I first got familiarized with this, I was actually working with Wes, and we would even do this orally sometimes. And it sucked. It was so hard to try and come up with three sometimes. But after I got like 20, 30 pages into these exercises, it was just like bang, 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 bang. And there was no judgment about what I was writing. It was like you were turning it over to the subconscious. And there's some preparation that's needed for that. I think it relates to some of the other advice that preceded this part of the show, where you have to be more open to just letting your mind work, letting things come into your consciousness from seemingly somewhere else. That process, through practice, becomes easier. So what Altucher suggests in his write 10 ideas down, and I think this came from, I forget the article, I'll find it. I just clipped that little piece of advice into Evernote, into my outline for this show. With practice, it becomes easier. Over time, prompts or even just a desire to generate ideas leads to more ideas being generated. That has been my experience. And in introducing this, I mentioned one more. I said reading, writing, and synthesis. But I think I'm actually going to hold off on talking about synthesis until later in the month. That's just the term I use for this weird practice that I've actually done off and on since maybe I was like 21 or 22 years old. It's very bizarre. And it actually began with my discovery. I didn't discover it, but being told about how the Wizard of Oz movie syncs up with the Pink Floyd album Dark Side of the Moon. We'll just cliffhang that for now, but we'll probably get into that in more detail later, because another podcaster, when he heard that we were doing this theme, he actually asked if he could interview me about my creative process for School Sucks Podcast, and I think that's a more appropriate place to discuss my bizarre synthesis activity. Now, we're not having this conversation because I'm a master of creative production. We're having these conversations this month because I want to improve. I want to break creative barriers that I currently feel are constraining me, stopping me from reaching my true potential. So from here, we're going to move into some conversations with some creative people that I admire, but there is still time for your suggestions. So please feel free to post them as comments in this show or on Facebook. And it's going to be a great month. I hope that what I've shared so far has been helpful for you. And I want your advice as much as I want to give you mine, or transmit the advice of other people to you through this podcast. So don't hesitate to share. I want to finish with a TED Talk that I was actually reminded of yesterday by my encounter with this strange cat on the railroad tracks. You'll see what I mean. It conveniently provides a strong reinforcement of some of the themes that we have covered in the first two shows. Thanks for listening, everybody, and take care. So it was during my teaching career where I started to think more frequently and more carefully about creative thinking, or lack thereof, in the schools, while also reflecting on my own experience. And it was shortly after that, and partially thanks to other new influences like John Taylor Gatto, that I started to try to formulate a list of hidden lessons in the school experience. And the second of three that I've outlined in the show was conformity, which is often subtle in the school environment, but very, very persistent. So this TED Talk is called Creativity as a Life Skill, and it is delivered by a college professor of all things named Gerard Puccio, professor of the International Center for Studies in Creativity at Buffalo State University. Here we go.
Imagine. We've all been endowed with this gift of imagination. And I'm going to ask you to use your imagination to picture in your mind's eye a tiger. I'm going to give you a little help. Tigers have colorful stripes for camouflage. On average, tigers grow to about 11 feet, weighing more than 600 pounds. Of all cats that exist in the world today, they have the longest canine teeth, about 2.5 inches long. Now I'd like you to imagine that you've just come face to face with a very unhappy tiger. What do? Are you fast enough to outrun the tiger? I doubt it very much. Are you strong enough to out-wrestle the tiger? I doubt that too. Why did I ask you to think about a tiger? Well, it could be because I teach at Buffalo State, and Buffalo State College, our mascot, happens to be a Bengal tiger. But that's not it. I could tell you that one of the most enjoyable reads I've had in the last year was The Life of Pi, which has been released as a major motion picture. And if you are familiar with that, then you know one of the characters in the book is a tiger. But that's not it. Tigers first appeared 2 million years ago. The Homo genus, humans, appeared 2.5 million years ago. Think about it. Look at yourself. How on earth did we ever survive given threats like that in our environment? How is that possible? Here's one answer: conformity. Psychological research done in the 1950s and 60s shows that humans have what's called a conformity bias. We tend to do what other people do. It's the way we're wired. I'll give you a visual demonstration of that. A YouTube video of an old TV program, many of you probably won't remember it, I remember it from my childhood, called Candid Camera, a hidden camera. If you're familiar with like Disaster Date, MTV, it's kind of like the precursor to Disaster Date. So in this scene from Candid Camera, there are three actors on an elevator facing the back of the elevator. And then a fourth person comes in who unknowingly is being videoed. He's not part of the program. Let's see what happens.
Now we try it once again. Here's the candid subject. Here comes the candid camera staff, three of them at least. And this man has apparently been in groups before.
So it makes you wonder, when you see something like that, how on earth did we survive? Well, there's an evolutionary advantage to conformity. In fact, there are three. The first is conformity allows for collaboration. You want to take down a great big woolly mammoth? Get some friends. It also helps in aiding with learning. By observing others, we can see them test ideas, and then we take what's successful, and we use those ourselves. And the third is it creates culture. We have shared values and norms. But if all we ever did was conform, then we wouldn't have growth. We would never try anything new. Let me try this out with you. Physical analogy. If you're holding something sharp, please put it down. And fold your arms in front of you as you would naturally. Note which forearm you have on top. I have my left forearm on top. When I asked you to put your arms together, how did that feel? Comfortable, right? Did you have to think about it? Probably not. Take your arms apart this time and weave them together so the opposite forearm ends up on top. Some of you are trying to figure it out. Same arms. The first time you folded your arms, that's what conformity feels like. It's comfortable, and you don't have to think. You just follow. But if that's all you ever did, you would never grow. Eventually, because conditions change, we have to try new things. Conformity has been talked about in terms of its role in evolution, but I want to suggest to you today that there's another part of that equation, and that's creativity. So while conformity is necessary for evolution, I would suggest that it's not sufficient, that it also requires creativity. And let me see if I can make a case by looking at human history. And it's probably likely that the seeds for creativity began even before humans emerged in Africa, probably with our ancestors who used sticks for tools. But let's stick with human history. The first tool invented, created, manufactured by humans, Homo habilis, occurred 2.5 million years ago. It's called the flake tool. It was a rock that was sharpened at one edge that could be used for splitting nuts and fruit. That lasted almost 1.4 million years. Now, if all we ever did was conform, we'd still be using that tool today. But something happened. Someone imagined another possibility. And that led to an innovation in stone tools called the hand axe. It's a symmetrical tool that can be held easily in the palm of the hand, which made striking much easier. That lasted about 600,000 years. And then something interesting happened. About 40,000 years ago, there was something archaeologists call the creative explosion. In Africa, Homo sapiens emerged, the anatomically modern human. Homo sapiens took imagination and went beyond functional use of imagination, and they applied it to diverse areas. For example, at this time, we went from thrusting weapons, which means you have to be close to your prey, to throwing weapons. Body decorations emerged. Art emerged for the first time, cave paintings, burial rituals, the production of clothing, purpose-built shelter, and so forth. What I suggest to you as a result of this, human history demonstrates that you were born to be creative. It's a natural part of who you are. But it doesn't have to stop there. We don't have to wait for our creativity to occur, to magically appear. What we know through research is that you can take what's innate and you can develop it further. We can engage in what's called deliberate creativity. Creativity is like any other skill, like all abilities. What does that mean? We all have it. You've been born with it. We're not all the same. So we vary in the degree of creative ability that we have. But what we know is that through deliberate practice, through training, and through learning, you can enhance your creative thinking. In fact, that's the reason why we exist at Buffalo State. The founding faculty members of our department conducted an empirical study. Students who went through a creativity course, when compared to a control group, showed significant cognitive gains. So what is this creative cognition? What is this innate set of thinking skills that we're all born with? The two skills that we're all born with is an ability to engage in divergent thinking and convergent thinking. And some scholars believe about 40,000 years ago, one of the reasons why we had a creative explosion is that the mind developed, evolved in such a way that Homo sapiens could begin to control their thinking and they could shift. It's called contextual focus. They could shift from divergent to convergent thinking. Divergent thinking is the ability to generate many varied and original options. It's the creation of variation. Convergent thinking is the selection, development of the most promising options. Now, isn't it interesting? Sounds a lot like evolution, doesn't it? What are the two fundamental properties of evolution? The creation of variation and the selective retention of those novel variations which enhance the ability to survive. So the same thought process seems to parallel the process of evolution. This is what we all have innately. But although we have this innate skill, we don't often use this skill, this gift, if you will, to the best of our ability. So let me talk a little bit about deliberate creativity. So we can all engage in divergent thinking, we can all engage in convergent thinking. What often happens when we have an idea, this novel idea? Sometimes the next thought that enters our mind is what? A reason why it won't work. It's too risky. So-and-so will criticize me. Here's another example that may make it easier to recognize this ineffective thought process. Imagine a meeting. Someone's called a meeting. There's a problem that has to be solved. The person who called the meeting says, right, we've got this tough nut of a problem. Anybody have any ideas? And someone shares an idea. What's often the next comment in that meeting?
Won't work.
Yeah, it won't work. We don't have the budget for it. That's crazy. How about this one? We've tried that before. What happens to the creativity? It gets sucked out of the room, right? And what happens is we stick with the tried and true, this area of familiarity, really not that divergent in our thought process. We conform to what's known. So although we have this innate skill, sometimes we don't use it effectively. How can we deliberately enhance this skill of creative thinking? Well, two tips for you. First of all, learn how to suspend your judgment, to defer judgment. How often have you quickly criticized an idea only to find out later it really worked? If you move quickly to convergence, to judge fast, you may limit your ability to see new possibilities. Second tip, go for quantity. This is well documented. Dean Simonton, creativity researcher who looked at eminently creative people, found that one of the main differences between eminently creative people and ordinary people like myself is that eminently creative people generate many more ideas. Picasso had 20,000 works of art. Shakespeare wrote 154 sonnets, 37 plays. Edison, George Washington Carver, well-known inventors, had many invention ideas, of which a few revolutionized the world. I learned recently by listening to NPR that Hemingway wrote 40 different endings to his book, For Whom the Bell Tolls, before he chose which one to go with. Linus Pauling, the Nobel laureate, said it best. The best way to have a good idea is to have lots of ideas. So if you want to be deliberately more creative, take advantage of what nature has given you. Learn to suspend your judgment. Don't jump to conclusions too quickly. and learn to generate many ideas. Why is this important? Historically, hopefully I've made the case for how creativity has been part of our evolution, but that's historically. I would say today, creativity and creative problem solving has never been more important. The flake tool that I shared with you earlier lasted for how long? 1.4 million years. Today, manufactured products go through fundamental redesign every 5 to 10 years. In the area of technology, it's every 6 to 12 months. We can't afford to wait a million years for the next good idea. Right? We can't afford to wait for the creativity muse to give us the breakthrough. We have to find ways to be deliberately creative, to accelerate what nature and evolution has given us. A global study completed recently, in fact this year by Adobe, conducted around the world, 80% of those who were surveyed said that creativity is important to economic growth. When asked about their own creativity, 1 out of 4 surveyed, 1 out of 4 said that they were living up to their creative potential. When asked about their creativity experiences, especially their educational experiences, 59% said that schools stifled their creativity. And the U.S., because we like to lead the world, the number was higher. It was 62%. So what's happening? Here's one reason for why schools stifle creativity. This comes from Mark Runko, a creativity researcher. He says that most educational experiences or most educational efforts focus on convergent thinking. Remember divergent and convergent thinking? Finding the single right answer. Wouldn't it be nice if life was that simple? If every problem we came up to had only one single right answer? But it's not. And he says, therefore, these educational experiences may do very little, if anything, for creative potential. I would go a little further and suggest that in an era of standardization and accountability in schools, perhaps what we're teaching children to do is to be good conformists instead of teaching them how to be independent thinkers. Well, let's make this a little more personal. How about you and your creativity? Think about the degree to which you balance conformity and creativity in your own lives. Do you engage in flexible thinking? Do you engage in flexible behavior? Do you try new things? Are you open-minded? You may never, I hope, have to wrestle a tiger. But life is complex, and I am sure you will have to wrestle with tenacious problems. J.P. Guilford, one of the pioneers in the field of creativity, said, "To live is to have problems, and to solve problems is to grow creatively." Remember, evolution may not have made you particularly strong or particularly fast, but evolution has given you the gift of a creative mind. If you deliberately use it, if you deliberately develop it, I guarantee you, you will be more successful in dealing with life's complexities. Thank you.